I think on the abortion question, like, we might, you know, you said it's not a final victory. I think this is, you know, just, it's a preliminary victory. That, you know, we have to get rid of Roe and Casey in order to then do the work that really matters, right? I mean, getting rid of Roe and Casey isn't even a, you know, a victory in and of itself, because getting rid of those two bad court rulings on its own doesn't do anything. It's the laws that will spring into effect that will protect babies. It's the laws that we have to enact that will protect babies. And so this gets rid of a hurdle, but now we need to legislate, you know, in all 50 states and at the federal level.
Join the best in the movement. It's Conservative Conversations with ISI, educating for liberty since 1953.
Welcome back. You're listening to Conservative Conversations with Marlo, Nate, and Johnny.
Today, our guest is Ryan T. Anderson, president of the Ethics and Public Policy Center and the founding editor of Public Discourse. Ryan is the author or co-author of 5 books, including the forthcoming Tearing Us Apart, How Abortion Harms Everything and Solves Nothing, and When Harry Became Sally, Responding to the Transgender Moment. Thanks for joining us, Ryan.
Sure thing. Happy to be with you guys.
Before we get started with our interview, I'd like to thank you for listening to Conservative Conversations. This podcast is a production of the Intercollegiate Studies Institute. Our mission at ISI is to educate for liberty. If you'd like to help us in pursuing that mission, please rate and review this podcast on Apple Podcasts and to help us reach more listeners like yourself. So as Johnny mentioned, Ryan, you have a forthcoming book called Tearing Us Apart, How Abortion Harms Everything and Solves Nothing. And you're joining us at a moment where pro-life advocates across the country are anxiously awaiting the imminent Supreme Court case, a ruling on the case that could overrule Roe v. Wade. So a good place to start here would be to perhaps talk about your forthcoming book and tell us a little bit, you know, about the book and especially its importance in the context of conversations of what a post-Roe America could look like.
Sure. Yeah. So my co-author is Alexandra DeSantis, who I think, was she an ISI fellow at NR at one point, maybe 5 or 6 years ago?
I think she was the Buckley Fellow.
Oh, she was the Buckley Fellow. I was going to say, I remember she got her start at NR in one of those fellowships. I couldn't remember if it was your fellowship or not. But Alexandra is, to my mind, one of the sharpest kind of pro-life speakers, writers, journalists of her generation. She's, I don't know, maybe a decade younger than I am. So I don't know if we're technically in the same generation or not. But we could count to 5 a little less than a year ago as the Dobbs case was heading towards the Supreme Court for oral arguments. And Mississippi, you know, made the bold stance. A lot of the DC litigators were saying, don't ask to overturn Roe and Casey. Just ask them to uphold your 15-week law without going all the way. And to their great credit, the AG and the SG in Mississippi asked them to finally admit that they got it wrong 49 years ago. And we thought that they had the votes, that they could count to 5. We could count to 5. And obviously, you know, when we wrote the book, we didn't know Alito's leaked opinion would be leaked, but there were 5, right? So the thought was, this will be the first time in 50 years that pro-lifers can meaningfully enact meaningful protections, both for the babies and for the mothers. But that means we're going to have to persuade people. If the court, you know, says that Roe and Casey are overturned, that doesn't outlaw abortion, right? I mean, they're not going to be ruling in favor of the, you know, John Finnis, Robbie George, 14th Amendment personhood argument, at least not in this case. And, you know, current court, I can't count to 5 for that argument. So the most likely outcome is that they're going to say this is returned to the democratic branches of government. And that means state houses and the federal government. That means Congress and the executive branch. And that means we're going to have to persuade voters to vote pro-lifers into office. That means we're going to have to persuade citizens when there's direct ballot initiatives on life. And that meant we need a fresh presentation of the basic pro-life argument, but then also extending the basic pro-life argument. Everyone who's pro-life knows the basic case about how abortion, you know, kills an unborn child. But as the subtitle suggests, abortion harms everything it touches. It solves nothing. And that's what we do kind of systematically, chapter by chapter by chapter, just document, you know, all of the carnage that abortion has left in its wake.
Ryan, can you tell us a little bit more about why you think abortion harms everything? I mean, I think for a lot of people, even some social conservatives, they think of abortion as sort of a siloed off issue, where it's a sort of specific issue. It revolves around your view of when life begins, but it's not necessarily connected to all of the other cultural or political issues that we're dealing with. Obviously, the thesis of your book is that it's much more far reaching. So could you go into that a little bit?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, we'll First chapter is about how it kills the unborn baby. Second chapter, how it harms women. And, you know, part of that chapter is going to be, you know, tangible, discrete, you know, physical or psychological harms. But leave that to this aside for a moment, because I think your question is saying, well, you know, how does it impact the larger culture? And here I think our colleague at EPPC, Erica Bakiaki, you know, her book was with the finalist for the ISI Prize last year. You guys, you know, made a mistake in picking someone else as the winner. But we appreciate
it. She was a guest on our podcast.
Though. Okay, right, so you know where I'm going with this. You know, Erica has the phrase asymmetrical reproduction. And the reality is that for human beings, reproduction is asymmetrical. The male and the female role aren't the same. They're not symmetrical. And what we've done for the past 49 years is said that equality means sameness. And the way in which we're going to structure our economy, we're going to structure our laws, our policy, our educational system, is that for women to compete against men, they have to sterilize their bodies. And so rather than saying, you know, we're going to create an economy that takes the female form of embodiment seriously, we're going to create a higher education system that takes the female way of being human seriously, which means that, you know, we might have different trajectories, different timelines for when people complete degrees based upon, you know, the asymmetrical realities of human reproduction. We haven't done any of that, right? What we've said is sterilize your body first through contraception, there then through, if contraceptive failure occurs, through abortion. And we've more or less said to people like my wife, your body is somehow defective. Your husband's body is the norm. And if you want to compete in the market and in higher education, you need to make your body more like his. I would also say that abortion is the ultimate backstop for the sexual revolution. When and where the sexual revolution takes off, it's not just a result of ideas. It's also a result of kind of material realities. I think something similar is very true of the transgender stuff. It's not just bad ideas. You need synthetic testosterone, synthetic estrogen, puberty blockers, or else none of that happens, right? And so there's both an ideological component and there's, you know, the material substrate. And I think first contraception and then abortion is the ultimate kind of backstop for what allows so-called consequence-free sex to take place, right? And it's saturated our society, the hookup culture, cohabitation, premarital sex, non-marital sex. I mean, it's not even accurate to say premarital because it's not even taking place, you know, prior to what will eventually be marital. It's just non-marital sex. Abortion's harmed all of that. And so then further, you could say that it's harmed the relationships between the sexes. It's harmed relationships between men and women. If it's her body, her choice, then it's also her obligation, her responsibility, right? Should the mother choose life? Well, her body, her choice, her responsibility. And this is where you see the rise of deadbeat dads, et cetera, et cetera. All right, and that's just the second chapter, right? I mean, third chapter looks at how it harms people in the periphery of life, people with disabilities, sex selective abortion, racial dynamics. It's, you know, more Black babies are aborted than born in New York City, et cetera, et cetera. It's corrupted the medical field. It's corrupted our politics. I mean, pro-life Democrats used to be a thing. Now they're an endangered species. And therefore, it's held citizens hostage. There are lots of pro-life citizens who feel captive to a Republican Party that pays lip service, not only on the life issue, but on so many other issues. They don't have a meaningful choice when it comes to voting because one political party is, you know, dead set committed to an injustice and a violation of a fundamental human right. The other political party isn't, but they might, you know, not support the economic agenda or the foreign policy agenda of that political party. We could go on, but I mean, like, we do go on for 250 pages in the book, but that's why we thought it would actually be helpful to do like a comprehensive, you know, restating of the pro-life argument to help our primary audience is actually, you know, people like us, people who are probably already inclined to be pro-life. And it's meant to equip those pro-life readers to then have conversations with their friends who aren't yet pro-life. And then you know your friends, so you know which entry point they're going to be most receptive to, right? And so, you know, part of rhetoric is knowing, all right, well, here's where I want to get to, which line of argument's going to work with this particular audience to get me there. And we have lots of different arrows in our quiver in terms of getting there.
It's interesting that you mentioned transgenderism there, Ryan, because obviously you are also someone who's written extensively about that issue. Your book, When Harry Met Sally, was all about the transgender moment in America. And the framework that you were setting up in the first part of your question, where you were talking about demanding that women essentially conform to the male body and sterilize their own bodies in order to participate in so much of American public life today. To me, it seems like the logical conclusion of that is transgenderism, right? And perhaps an aspect of the sort of transgender fervor that we've seen in the last 5 years very much has to do with this idea that women have to essentially become men to be deemed competitive in the economy, in higher education, et cetera. Do you see that as sort of a through line? I mean, obviously, I think it's clear that transgenderism is sort of the inevitable conclusion of the sexual revolution. When you transform the definition of men and women and the relationship to one another, eventually you just wipe away those categories altogether. But do you think there's a specific through line from the abortion issue to the transgender issue?
I do. I don't know if it's quite the way you just articulated it, although I don't know if I don't think that. I would need to think about it more, because I mean, here's how I would conceptualize it. I've written five books on different topics, gay marriage stuff, religious liberty stuff, transgender stuff, now abortion stuff. And I think all of them do have a common philosophical, anthropological underpinning. And it's true. It's body self dualism and it's expressive individualism. And so I think what's underlying the redefinition of marriage, the rise of kind of gender identity as the truth about who people are, claims about discrimination when people don't embrace your kind of self-professed identity, and then the abortion question, all of those two underlying realities, body self-dualism, in which the body is not the real you, right? The real you is something other than the body, and then the body is a costume or a vehicle for a second part, you to give expression to the real you, right? So that's where the expressive individualism and the dualism actually come together here. And what this looks like is it means the unborn child may be a human being from a, quote, purely biological standpoint, right? So we're not going to be science deniers. Like even Peter Singer is willing to admit that the unborn child is a human being. He says, but it's not a moral person. It hasn't yet achieved personhood status because it doesn't have the higher intellectual capacities, self-awareness, self-consciousness, rationality, et cetera, et cetera. That's the person, and it's something other than the body. The debate over same-sex marriage was, look, the body, the plumbing doesn't matter. And it's just plumbing. You know, what matters is that we can give expression to our romantic feelings for each other, our love for each other, our commitment. And the body is just a vehicle for the expressive individualistic self that inhabits the body. And then I think the ultimate version of this is, well, if our bodies don't matter for sexual relationships, for uniting as one flesh in marriage, well, then why does our body even matter for our own identity, right? I mean, our sex bodies matter most precisely in how they capacitate us for union as one flesh. And if we're going to say that doesn't matter, well, why does it even matter that some of us happen to have male bodies and some of us happen to have female bodies, right? The true self is the gender identity self. And then maybe our body, you know, sex assigned at birth isn't the real sex. And so modern medicine can reassign sex, right? I mean, to my mind, that's the through line for all of these issues. It's the combination of both a body self dualism and an expressive individualism. And it's really just had, you know, horrific consequences, right? And so I think the further and further we get away from both a sound philosophical and a sound theological understanding of anthropology, the worse the consequences are getting.
Ryan, I'm curious, when Texas passed the fetal heartbeat law last fall, I know they also, it went perhaps unreported, but they also designated a significant amount of funding to supporting, you know, women's health from a more pro-life perspective. And I'm kind of curious what you see if Roe is overturned. As what is your vision and the vision of EPPC for pro-family policy generally, if abortion were to be?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Overturned. Good question. You're exactly right. So the media covered the Texas heartbeat bill and they ignored the $100 million that the legislature allocated to the Texas Alternatives to Abortion program. And that's, I think that's even broader than kind of like a pro-family agenda, because, you know, for many of those women who feel that they, quote, need abortion, they're not necessarily in a family context. One of the safest places to be conceived in America is to be conceived inside of marriage. Abortion rates inside of marriage are rather low. Abortion rates for single women are, you know, rather high. And so anyway, there's a variety of things that you could do. The Texas Alternative to Abortion program is wonderful in providing public funding to provide women with prenatal health care, to provide women with shelter, with diapers, with formula, with, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Fill in the blanks. Florida, Governor Ron DeSantis, probably now 2 months ago, passed a fatherhood initiative bill. And our colleague at EPPC, Patrick Brown's written a really nice piece for City Journal discussing that. But a huge role here is women who do not have supportive partners, sexual partners, the fathers of their kids, frequently feel economically constrained or socially constrained, or frequently just pressured, I shouldn't even say constrained, into seeking an abortion. And so fatherhood initiatives will be important. And then just last week, Romney introduced his new family policy plan, which, you know, Patrick had been helping the office with, and Patrick's written a piece, I think it was for the Dispatch, discussing it. And I think all these things should be on the table. One nice thing I'll point out the Romney plan is that, you know, this is a, it's the second iteration of an earlier version of this bill, where Yuval Levin at AEI supported the earlier version. Scott Winship at AEI did not. Now both of them support it, right? So Romney listened to the critics. He made some adjustments to it. And now both Yuval and Scott at AEI support this. It's endorsed by a whole host of pro-life groups. If I remember correctly, it's like National Right to Life, Susan B. Anthony List, the Family Research Council, et cetera, et cetera. And so I actually think there's something providential that the very moment in time when Roe, you know, God willing, tomorrow or sometime next week, the Supreme Court will be, you know, formally overturning Roe, that very same moment in time, there's a greater willingness amongst Republican office holders and conservative intellectuals to think about how we care both about markets and about other things. And we have to actually put these things into conversation with each other. I think for too long, there were so-called social issues or cultural issues that were supposed to be addressed purely in the culture, and then economic questions that we're supposed to have public policy about. And we never, to my mind, the failure of fusionism was that nothing was really fused. It was, we're going to, at the conceptual level, say we care about all of these things, but then at the policy level, it's not that we've actually fused something together and come up with something greater than the sum of its parts. It's that one group's actually going to get policy that reflects their political objectives, and the other group's going to be given kind of cultural remedies. Anyway, so I'm hopeful there. And I think it's important that we see that, like, a conservative family policy needs to take markets seriously. And, you know, and Romney's plan does. It's not as if, you know, if you just say common good frequently enough that, you know, supply and demand realities and price signals and, you know, things like this no longer matter, right? And so a conservative family policy should look different than the Bernie Sanders family policy or the Joe Biden family policy, and the Romney plan does, right? And so I think it's providential that it's happening at this moment in time. And then I just think it's a series of both ands. And what I mean by that is people will say, you know, it's either state level pro-life stuff or feds, both and. There's a role for both. You know, it's either the supply of abortion, Planned Parenthood, or the demand for abortion, like the underlying reasons why women seek abortion. And it's not an either or, it's a both and, right? And so, you know, it's either a cultural response or it's a legal policy response. No, again, both and, both and. And I think that's going to be true. We need to pass legislation protecting babies and mothers from the harm of abortion. We also need to pass public policy that will enable more mothers to choose life for their children and to feel that they're empowered to not, quote, need abortion. And again, a series of both ands. I think these false dichotomies can derail us quite a bit.
Ryan, Senator Ron Johnson from Wisconsin, when he was criticizing, I think it was the child tax credit, said that he's never really felt like it was society's responsibility to take care of children. Obviously, that's not your position. It's not my position either, but I'm curious to think or to hear why you think that's wrong.
Well, I mean, I don't even know where to begin because I don't even know. So whose responsibility is it to care for children? Right? When he says he doesn't think it's society's, of course it's society's responsibility. But the only question is how, right? I mean, so I think he wasn't even giving a good articulation to what he must really believe. Of course, I mean, if you think of like, society is, you know, people living together in community. Well, then of course we have responsibility, obligations, care, and concern for the next generation. And obviously the way that I fulfill those obligations to my kids is going to be different than how I fulfill it for Johnny's kids. But I can't just be indifferent to the well-being of Johnny's children, right? I can't just be like indifferent to the well-being of my neighbor's children. Although like how I directly assist my kids and, you know, fulfill my obligations to my kid, it will be different because I have different obligations to my kids and to the neighbor's kids. But I mean, does Ron Johnson not know that we have government-funded, government-run public schools, right? Is that society saying it has some obligation to the next generation when it comes to education? No, I think it's a hugely problematic way in which we fulfill that obligation. I don't think we should have a government-created monopoly on the provision of public education, right? And so I think anyone who educates the public should be eligible for public assistance, public funding in that. And I think lots of, quote, private schools are engaged in public education. So I'm all on board for voucher programs, education savings accounts, et cetera. But then we have to structure those appropriately so that they don't then get co-opted through endless red tape and regulation where they become, you know, there's no difference between them and the government-run public schools, right? I mean, the school choice, you know, can achieve good results precisely because it creates differences and it creates options. But if you just have a choice of, you know, five different schools, all of which are going to be doing the same woke ideology, the same, you know, B-rate standards of academics, then you don't really have a meaningful choice. I got derailed on school choice for a minute, but I mean that's how I would start thinking, you know, responding to someone like Ron Johnson. Like, of course we have responsibilities. The question is, how do we structure it? I think, you know, in education, separate the funding from the delivery, fund students, empower the parents to have the funding, follow the student to the school that the parents pick, et cetera, et cetera. And then something true would be the case when it comes to the financial costs of, you know, newborns, right? And there's no reason why there's not a role for, you know, either a safety net, you know, tax credits, et cetera, et cetera. To provide more people to feel that they have the financial resources simply to have the kids that they already report desiring. And if you look at our desired, you know, the self-reported, how many children do you want to have, desired fertility versus actual fertility? And we're consistently below. And there are a variety of reasons why, not all are economic, but insofar as there are economic reasons, there's nothing wrong with having a public policy that won't, you know, be heavy-handed, that won't distort markets. I mean, there's a variety of ways in which you could get this wrong. So for example, if you only are going to provide financial assistance to pay for daycare, but you're not going to provide financial assistance to allow more mothers to do what they report wanting to do, right? They want to have flex time jobs where they work so many hours in the home and so many hours outside of the home, right? A one side fits all, like Bernie Sanders' plan of, you know, we're going to pay for universal daycare, but we're not going to provide any assistance for families who want to, you know, actually be at home with their kids, non-starter.
To kind of flesh out the point of economics that you made, I'm also curious because I do pro-life work through like the Catholic Church, but I have a lot
it's
of
a great
friends.
Church.
It is a great church, if I may say so myself. But I think there are also secular pro-lifers who do really good work as well. I have quite a few friends in that orbit who are extremely devout, you know, they're really dedicated to the pro-life cause. And one of the interesting points that I think they make is who seeks to profit off of abortions. And, you know, obviously this is kind of coming from my sense is it's pharmaceutical and also medical and also just on the point of puberty blockers and other hormonal substances that are often used in the kind of, you know, in transgenderism, especially in transgender youth or, you know, what some politicians might call gender affirmation or what have you. There's also the argument that someone or an industry, multiple industries are benefiting there's a profit motive there for expanding that sort of access. So on the topic of both abortion and you know, transgenderism and these the therapies and the surgeries that go along with that, what's the profit motive there and what industries benefit the most from these procedures?
Yeah, I mean, so clearly pharmaceutical companies in the case of the transgender stuff, but also, I mean, like there are physicians getting rich on this stuff. The surgeons who specialize, I mean, these are expensive procedures. There's one doctor I know of who has a website advertising that if you are, if you're non-binary, if you identify as gender ambidextrous, he can do surgeries where you will retain your existing genitalia and he will add appendages that resemble the opposite sex's genitalia. So you would end up having both sets of genitalia. And those things do not come cheaply. This is also why I think you see more and more the advocacy to have laws that will force all health insurance companies to pay for these procedures and then force all employers to have healthcare plans that pay for them. It's not just coming out of a, you know, we've discovered, like Joe Biden, that this is the human rights issue of our time. There are also some bottom line issues. All of that said, I do think that what really drives the boat, though, for the true believer is that they're true believers. When I see, especially some of the doctors pushing this stuff, including some of the doctors that Matt Walsh just, you know, recently, highlighted in his documentary, they're not doing it primarily for the money. I mean, there are other things you could do to make money as a physician. They went to school and became gender experts. They chose to specialize in this form of medicine because they really believe it. They want it to be the case that our bodies are plastic and that, you know, we can reconfigure them at will and people will be happy doing it. And I think a lot of that is true for the pro-abortion activists as well, that it's not so much a bottom line interest, although I'm not denying that, but I mean, like, I think for the true believer, that's their biggest motivation. And that's why you see, I mean, look, the people right now harassing the justices outside of their homes, those are the true believers. Now, some of them might be being paid. Like, I have no doubt that some of this is AstroTurf and that some of these might very well be, you know, paid actors showing up. But then you can ask yourself, well, why is someone so committed to this that they're willing to pay for this? And I think for some people, it really just is. They think that if they don't have access to abortion, they're not really equal. That this is for them, you know, it's all about autonomy and about self-determination.
Ryan, in terms of sort of assessing the state of social conservatism as it stands today, it's difficult because on the one hand, you know, it looks like we could be on the precipice, knock on wood, of Roe being overturned, which is obviously one of the sort of primary organizing social conservative goals of the last half century. But on the other hand, you know, transgenderism in particular is on the march. And you've obviously had run-ins with this directly when your book, When Harry Met Sally, was deplatformed from Amazon and you were sort of widely smeared for writing the book. So it seems like there's sort of two different poles in terms of where social conservatism is. On the abortion issue, we're poised for, if not a final victory, then a major victory in a longstanding battle. And on the other hand, we're fighting an increasingly aggressive ideology on sexuality and gender, which is not just more radical, but much more aggressive and less tolerant than it was just a few years ago. What do you think the state of play is for social conservatives today, reckoning with those sort of internal contradictions?
So lots of thoughts. I mean, one is that I actually think we're on better footing on some of the transgender issues than the way you just phrased it would suggest, just because you do not need to be a conservative or a religious believer to think that what's going on, at least with respect to children and with respect to female athletics, is just utterly insane, right? And so there are lots of people who say, look, I'm fine if Bruce wants to be Caitlin. It's a free country. Bruce can be Caitlin. But they think puberty-blocking drugs for 9-year-olds. They think double mastectomies for 13-year-olds. They see the UPenn swim team and, you know, one of these people is not like the other. And you don't need to have deep religious faith or political conservatism. And there are lots of people finding their voices. I mean, when I first started doing work on gender identity issues back in like 2015, 2016, it was pretty lonely. And, you know, there were times when I was like, geez, is anyone else going to speak out? And then little by little, more and more people did. And, you know, back when I was at the Heritage Foundation, there were some public events that I hosted there, you know, with self-identified, you know, radical feminists, including in one case, like the first lesbian reinstated to the military after Don't Ask, Don't Tell was lifted. And, you know, and several times some of those women said, you know, thank you to the Heritage Foundation for providing me with something that no left-leaning group would, which was a platform. And so I think that the trans thing, it's not a house of cards that's just going to collapse on its own. Like, you know, we actually need to make it collapse. But I do think that your average American is much more reasonable on trans issues than not. And so I do have, you know, some hope there. I think on the abortion question, like we might, you know, you said it's not a final victory. I think this is, you know, just, it's a preliminary victory that, you know, we have to get rid of Roe and Casey in order to then do the work that really matters, right? I mean, getting rid of Roe and Casey isn't even a, you know, a victory in and of itself, because getting rid of those two bad court rulings on its own doesn't do anything. It's the laws that will spring into effect that will protect babies. It's the laws that we have to enact that will protect babies. And so this gets rid of a hurdle, but now we need to legislate, you know, in all 50 states and at the federal level. And there, I mean, some of the states that are most populated, California, Massachusetts, New York, Illinois, are some very deep blue states with some very bad laws. And then I can't count to 60 right now. And so long as there's a legislative filibuster, it's really hard to get any legislation out of the Senate that would be meaningfully protective of the unborn. You know, we can try. I think there's, you know, there are some things that could be possible and must pass legislation. But where I'm most kind of concerned, it's neither with abortion or trans rights. It's more with just like sexual revolution as a whole. The virtue of chastity, the idea that sex is not a recreational activity, but it's like a profoundly significant action that should only be performed by a husband and a wife to embody their marital commitment. We're a pretty far way away from having a majority of Americans truly believe that, and even further away from having a majority of Americans actually live it out or even aspire to live it out. And to my mind, like that's actually, you know, it's rather important. And I think we're pretty far away there. And that would be my barometer because, you know, I want my kids to grow up in a culture in which they can find spouses and have like healthy, happy, flourishing families of their own. And it's going to be much more difficult in a culture that has normalized sexual activity as recreation and everything that goes along with it.
Ryan, this past weekend, I was up in a small little village in PA, not far where I live, close to Lancaster. And I was in this charming historic downtown and they had this bookstore. And, you know, right in the front windows of this bookstore, they had all of their transgender and LGBT books, but specifically an entire set of books for children. And they were children's storybooks sort of promoting gender ideology and things like that. And so I guess I'm a little bit torn when I think about, I'm torn between your modest optimism and Nate's pessimism, because you do see, right, there is some pushback against the acceleration of transgenderism in girl sports and things like that, treatments for children. But at the same time, the other side seems to be, you know, they've made it their way to rural PA, Amish country. And this is just, you know, now it's right in the downtown and this is totally normal. And so I'm wondering whether or not you think, you know, I don't know, I could see a sort of a temporary victory where maybe the way that in Virginia, we saw people activate behind Glenn Youngkin around CRT. I can sort of see a potential ratcheting back on the trans issue in select localities. But I don't know. I kind of think that without a restoration of a Christian understanding of marriage and sexuality, even if it's just that heterosexual monogamy is sort of the norm, and there might be deviations from the norm, but the norm is sort of ought to be the key operating principle behind how we understand sexuality. Without that happening, I just kind of see us maybe, you know, sliding the scale back to like the mid-aughts, you know, getting to, but then we're going to slide right back down the hill if there's not some sort of glue that can actually hold together the new ethic. So I don't know, how do you see this holding together?
A couple of thoughts there. One is I think the example you just gave speaks more to, you know, the boldness of the people who own bookstores in, you know, small downtown, you know, America than it does about like what actual parents believe. And I think it's much more of a, for too long, too many parents have bit their tongues. It's a book by Jim DeMint, former president of Heritage, was titled Why We Whisper. And, you know, his whole thesis was that like, we actually, like, we don't believe all this stuff. And so we whisper, you know, what we really believe about marriage, what we really believe about abortion, because, you know, all of the elites that we fear the judgment of condescend to us. And I actually think this was one of the salutary effects of the Trump years, is that, you know, I think more people saw that, like, I don't have to care what my so-called betters think about me. I think this is one of the salutary effects of the COVID lockdowns for the past 2 years. It's that, like, the expert class doesn't know what they're doing, doesn't know what they're saying. The emperor has no clothes. And so again, like, I think you're right. Like, it's really bad. I'm not denying it's really bad. But the reason that I'm hopeful here is that I don't think ordinary Americans, at least on the trans thing, have bought into it. I do think ordinary Americans have bought into the hookup culture. Right. That's why, you know, my response to Nate, like, I see it much more problematic. I live in rural Virginia. I'm 5 minutes from where Maryland, Virginia, and West Virginia all kind of come together. And people here do not think a boy could be trapped in a girl's body, or that you could give, you know, puberty blockers and that would somehow be good for kids. But none of them think sex is reserved for marriage. None is an overstatement. But, you know, to my mind, like, that's a tougher nut to crack. And I think, Johnny, you're exactly right that, like, unless we return to kind of like a biblical understanding of both our embodiment, you know, so the body self-dualism part, but then also, like, that there are certain ends that are good for us, you know, by design, by creation, by nature, and marriage being one of those. And that, you know, sex is meant for marriage, so that, you know, and that's the response to the expressive individualism side. You know, our life is not about giving expression to our individuality, right? I mean, we're actually created with, you know, kind of certain trajectories, certain, there's a teleology to nature. There are certain ends that are perfective of us. And I think those things are much harder to push back on. Whereas I do think that, you know, most ordinary people who I encounter on a daily basis would roll their eyes at the Lancaster bookstore that you're talking about, but they might whisper, right, rather than speak out.
Unfortunately, Ryan, we are running out of time, so we are going to ask you the question that we ask all of our guests on the show before we close out, which is, how would you define conservatism? And maybe even how would you define social conservatism, especially when, to narrow it down a bit, especially when, as you said earlier, social conservatism shouldn't be perhaps, you know, distinguished from conservatism as a whole.
Sure. I mean, I would say conservatism is about truth and about reality. It's about recognizing that there are truths kind of built into reality. It's living in accordance with those truths. And it's about recognizing that you can't do this. What's the right way of putting it? Can't do this as an island, that human nature needs to be cultivated. Cultures cultivate things. So, like, agriculture, horticulture, human culture cultivates human nature, and the law and government has a big role to play there. And so what we're trying to do as conservatives, we're trying to conserve various traditions that reflect the truth about human nature and human flourishing. But therefore, I mean, I think this is where, you know, the more kind of like libertarian wing would come in, is that recognizing some of those truths also means, you know, respecting certain limits. Right? Limits to human nature, human perfectibility, therefore also limits to government authority. What this used to look like was, you know, I always like to quote George Will in Statecraft as Soulcraft. One, because he titled a book that. Right? Today's George Will doesn't think that, but, like, he saw that statecraft was soulcraft. And then George said that the four most important words in politics are up to a point. Right? You know, and then I think the very next sentence was, are we in favor of free markets? Yes, up to a point. Free trade? Yes, up to a point. And so conservatism, to my mind, is about defining those limits, defining what is up to that point. Ideology is going to, you know, so I think libertarianism is an ideology, right? Because it simplifies things. There's one highest principle, and we're trying to maximize it, right? This is the problem with utilitarianism in general. Various forms of liberalism, same problem. You know, various utopian forms of political ideology. Conservatism wants to be reality-based and say, all right, given the nature that we have, what ends are perfective of us, what moral truths need to be supported by culture, what role does law play in shaping culture, and then what are the potentials for abuse? So what are the guardrails that we have to set up? This is why I think the American founders were conservatives, right? Because they thought there were certain laws built into creation, built into nature. They thought there was a propensity for humans with authority to abuse that authority. So they placed limits on government. And then they left a lot of room for prudence and discretion and debate and et cetera, et cetera. And then I think various ideologies have tried to simplify that by, you know, elevating a single master principle, the greatest good for the greatest number, or, you know, maximizing individual liberty. And those things aren't properly speaking the core of the conservative tradition.
Great. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Ryan. If people are interested in seeing more of your work or following you, where can they find you? And when is your latest book set to be available?
Sure. So they can find me. I'm on, you know, social media type stuff. So Twitter, it's at Ryan T. And I have a personal Facebook page where you should not look me up, but I also have a public Facebook page. And I think it's like at, I don't know, if you just look for Ryan T. Anderson, something will pop up on Facebook there. The EPPC website, you know, archives all of my current writing projects. The Heritage website has all of my former writing projects. And then the book is set to release on Tuesday, June 28th. So that was our best guess back when we were writing the book of when Dobbs would be released. You know, we'll see when Dobbs does come out, but we wanted the book to come out in conjunction with Dobbs to really equip people for this next phase of the pro-life movement.
Great. Thanks again, Ryan.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you for listening to Conservative Conversations with ISI. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please feel free to head over to isi.org/resources to see all that we can offer our members, including the Intercollegiate Review, Select Modern Age articles, ISI books, and of course, this podcast. Thanks again for listening. Don't forget to rate and review, and we will see you next time on Conservative Conversations with ISI.